This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bahnsen Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Obviously, there, you know, people who study social anthropology, study man and his social relations and development and things like that. But we're going to be looking at it from the biblical point of view. And so, let's begin a new portion of our outline. And that means a new color of ink. So this is getting really exciting. And I want to speak to you, first of all, about the nature of man. The nature of man. And just so you know where we're going, the next major portion of our outline, although it'll take a while to get there, is going to be sin and its punishment. Sin and its punishment. The first subpoint under man's nature, I'm going to call the first subpoint man's origin. And the first thing I want to talk about under man's origin are the creation accounts of man. And then secondly, we'll talk about the evolutionary challenge. What is man? Everyone has got to answer that question, whether they're interested in Christian theology or not. Everyone does answer that question, whether they're a Christian or not. Everyone, because they are made in God's image, is forced to ask questions which aardvarks and camels and roses and other things don't do. Man is self-conscious. This is a fact of human psychology. It's something which everyone knows just from their own experience. And it's a rare, rare human being that doesn't at some point in his or her life ask the famous question from the movie, "What's it all about, Alfie?" What is man? What are we here for? What makes man different? How should we live our lives? Questions like that. What is man? The Bible begins first and foremost by telling us that you understand man when you understand his origin, when you understand where he came from. And so we open this morning to Genesis, the first chapter, and we read these well-known words. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The text goes on to explain, the earth was waste and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness, and God called the light day and the darkness night. There was evening and morning one day. And as we go through the account, we come to the sixth day of creation, after God has brought forth vegetation and animal life on the earth. Verse 24 tells us, God commanded the earth to bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle, creeping things, beasts of the earth after their kind, and it was so. And then in verse 26, and God said, "Let us make man in our image." This is the first introduction then in the Bible to this creature called man. Man is created on the sixth day of the creation week. He's created along with the other animated creatures, the beast of the earth, the creepy crawlies, and all the rest. Man is part of the animal kingdom. But man is different from the animals in the most significant way. We're going to come back to this. This is the beginning and the end of this consideration. Man is made as the image of God. You notice what I read at the beginning of this account. God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind." Everything in creation follows its own pattern, its own kind. Cattle bear cattle. Camels bear camels. Okay? Hummingbirds bear hummingbirds after their kind. And man comes forth after his kind as well. You get that? Man's a creature made on the sixth day with the others, the other animals. The animals come forth after their kind. Man comes forth after his kind. And this is what it says, and God said, "Let us make man in our image." The triune council brings forth man as his own image. God's image is seen in man. Man's kind, then, though he is of the earth, an animal, his kind is of heaven after God. He is made in the image of God. This is where the Bible begins the account. And you know, without that background, nothing else in the biblical story makes sense. It all begins here that man is more than an animal, yet he's tied to the earth. He's made in the image of God, and therefore he begins pristine and pure. And from there, you know the rest of the story. But you see, that story wouldn't make any difference. That story wouldn't make any sense if man were not who he is. God doesn't lay down his life, and I don't mean to be flippant, but he doesn't lay down his life for cockroaches. Why would God redeem man? What does redemption mean? Redemption presupposes sin. Sin presupposes dignity. See? And redemption points to the value of man, even as sin points to the degrading of the value of man. All of it comes back then to this very opening account that man was made in the image of God. Let's talk about the creation accounts themselves, since that has become a matter of controversy in this century. First of all, how should we interpret Genesis 1:1 through chapter 2, verse 3? Have you ever noticed that Genesis 1, the account, actually goes into chapter 2, the first three verses? We read, "The heavens and the earth were finished, all the host of them, and on the seventh day God finished the work which he had made." And after verse 3, where God blesses the Sabbath day, sets it apart. Verse 4 of what we call Genesis 2, I say we call because God didn't give us the chapter breaks in the verses. Somebody else did that. And they made a mistake on this one. God doesn't make any, but sometimes editors do. In what we call verse 4, which should be the beginning of a new chapter, I think, "These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created in the day that Jehovah God made earth and heaven. And no plant of the field was yet in the earth," and so forth and so on. And then it goes on to give the account more specifically and individually of Adam's creation, his naming of the animals, his seeking of a help appropriate to him, and God's provision, and then, of course, chapter 3, the fall of man into sin. What I want to look at first is the creation account in Genesis 1. When I say Genesis 1, I will mean Genesis 1:1 through 2:3. For sake of convenience. And when I speak of the creation account in Genesis 2, I will mean that which begins in verse 4 of chapter 2. So right now, we want to talk about the interpretation of Genesis 1 and the creation account given there. How are we to understand the days of creation? We read that God made the light, separated it from the darkness, and that was the first day. We go on through the account, and as I said, "And on the sixth day he created the creatures of the earth, including man." How do we understand these days? There are five possibilities that you should be aware of, because you'll run into this. As people come into your church and under your spiritual influence, they'll sometimes bring with them a lot of stuff that they've heard elsewhere, ideas they've come up with on their own. And when it comes down to understanding Genesis, it's not just a question of, you know, how we debate little, you know, bitty points with theologians or Bible interpreters or scientists or what have you. The reason why I'm going to take some time talking about creation is because if you don't understand man's origin, you don't understand man. And to understand man's origin, you have to understand how God brought this world about. What does the Bible say about the days of creation? The first interpretation of those days, which I'll tell you from the outset is my view, is that the days of creation are roughly 24-hour days. They are days just like you and I speak of days ordinarily. It took me a whole day to fix my car. Well, does that mean it took me precisely 24 hours, not a second less or a second more? No. But roughly, you know what a day is. And the Bible has the same kind of casual approach to talking when it speaks of the first day, the second day, the third day. It's not to be taken as a technical expression for 24 hours, So we measure by the sun. After all, the sun doesn't come until, what, the third day, fourth day of creation? So it's going to be something that is not measured by the rotation of the earth. Well, and then, you know, the sun being there to mark beginning and end of each rotation. But on the other hand, it is a day very much like we would understand one, because the Bible says there was evening and there was morning, a first day, a second day, a third day. So the greatest strength of this view is that it takes the language in the Bible without straining, reads it in its natural sense. Moreover, this interpretation, I think, becomes indisputable when we see in the Ten Commandments that God patterns, you know, the Sabbath commandment after His own behavior, if you will. We are to rest on the seventh day. Why? Because God rested on the seventh day. If these are not 24-hour days, roughly 24-hour days, then the Sabbath commandment doesn't have that foundation. I mean, if these are long ages, then when we come to the Sabbath, we ought to rest for a long period of time. Some people would like that. But if you're going to play that game, you've got to wait a long period of time to get there, too. Okay, so that's the first interpretation of the days of Genesis. The second one is called the gap theory. Originated with Thomas Chalmers and is made famous in the Scofield Reference Bible. The gap theory reads the second verse of Genesis 1 in a radical way, saying that the earth became something. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and now what we have is a little bit of history, and the earth became waste and void. So you have an initial creation, and then a dropping back into chaos, if you will, and then in verse 3, a recreation in 6 days. And God said, let there be light, according to verse 3. So you understand that you have a gap then inserted here. God created the world. For some reason, it became waste and void, and then God creates light and goes through the 6 days of creation. Now, why would anybody say this? Well, two things seem to motivate people who hold to the gap theory, neither one of which are convincing to me. You think about it yourself, though. One is, this would make it easy or easier to reconcile the biblical account of creation with what the scientists tell us about the long age of the earth. If the earth's been here as long as they say, and there's a gap in these opening verses of Genesis, then we can just drop anything the scientists say right into that gap, and we reconcile it. Well, it doesn't work quite that easily. If you know anything about apologetics, that doesn't really help a whole lot. It's an unnatural reading of verse 2 to say earth became waste and void. The second reason why the gap theory is given is because some theologians have a hard time understanding when Satan fell. Because we don't read of that in the Bible. We read that it happened, we don't read when it happened. So this gives us a convenient answer. Why did the earth become waste and void? Because Satan fell. So now we can not only put all the ages of the scientists for the earth right into that gap, now we can put this big theological question, a curiosity to us, when did Satan fall into that gap as well? A third view is the day-age theory of Genesis 1 that tells us that the days spoken of, a first day, a second day, and so forth, are really long geological ages rather than 24-hour periods. It'll be pointed out by those who hold this view that the word day in the Bible does not always mean 24-hour day, that the word day can refer to an age or a period of time of indefinite duration. Let's see if we can give an example. Psalm 90, verse 4. For 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday when it is past, and as a watch in the night. The idea here that for God, 24-hour days are not all that important. You know, this way of measuring time is for human convenience, but it isn't all that important to God. Isaiah 11:16. And there shall be a highway for the remnant of his people that shall remain from Assyria, like as there was for Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt. What day was that? I mean, it was a 40-year period. And so since the word day can be used that in that fashion, and we do as well, you know, we speak of the days of the Buccaneers, or the day of the Buccaneers, or the day of the Kennedy administration, or so day sometimes just means period. And it's been suggested that in Genesis 1, that's what you have. The advantage of this, again, is that it helps you to reconcile the Bible with what the scientists are saying, because it gives you long periods of time. The disadvantage of that is, at first, that is not the natural reading in this context for the word day. In fact, nowhere in the Bible do you have the Hebrew word for day, yom. Nowhere in the Bible, you get my point? Nowhere do you have the word day with a numerical adjective put with it, and it means long period of time. First day, second day, third day, fourth day are always days as we understand it in the seven-day week. So, since we read that here in Genesis, the natural reading would be it's like a week as you would understand a week, first day, second day, third day. And that's uniformly the case in the Bible. Secondly, I find the day-age theory suspect because I have never found a person who said that he read the text and he felt that from the text alone, that's what was being communicated by God. Always, at some point or another, you find out that there's this kind of eye over here watching what the scientists are telling us. You know, and then you say, well, you know, a day could be. But it's not the sort of thing you'd think of if you didn't have the pressure of trying to reconcile your biblical interpretation to outside scholarship. And I'm an apologist. I believe in defending the Christian faith, but I don't believe in bowing the knee to outside scholarship and say, okay, let's make sure the Bible fits in with what they say. A fourth view of the days of Genesis is what you might call a punctuated day-age theory. Here what you have are specific days that are literal, 24-hour days, but they are punctuated with long ages in between them. And so there was a first day where God separated light and darkness, then a long period of time. Then there was a second day, 24-hour day, then a long period of time, and then a third day, and a long period of time, and so forth. What might suggest this is that in the Hebrew, you don't have, and it was the second day, it was the third day. In Hebrew, you have, and it was a second day, it was a third day. So some scholars have thought, well, that allows then for punctuating geological ages in between this. Well, that does create a problem, though, in terms of long periods of time when the earth is incomplete. And somebody says, well, if it can be incomplete for 24 hours, it can go long periods of time. That's true. The sixth day becomes very difficult, though, because man's creation is simultaneous with the animals. Okay? And you don't then reconcile the geological or the fossil record very easily when you have just 24-hour periods punctuated by long gaps in between. And then a fifth view, and we'll be done with this stuff here, is what's called the framework theory or hypothesis of Genesis 1. According to the framework theory, the days of Genesis are not to be understood chronologically at all. They're not units of time. They are rather poetic or dramatic devices. If you will, we could liken them to scenes in a play. God gives us six dramatic scenes of His creative activity. Here emphasizing this, here emphasizing that. And the supposed advantage of this approach is that we find poetic devices. The refrain, and God said, and God made, and God saw. There was evening and morning. There was evening and morning. So we see a kind of literary structure. And not only that, we find symmetry between the first 3 days and the second 3 days. You look at what was created on day one. You have sun and moon. Day four, the second set of three. and you find that you have the sun and the moon corresponding. And day 2, day 5, day 3, day 6, that kind of symmetry has suggested that this is not intended chronologically, but topically. The problem with the framework theory is that if this was meant strictly as poetry, it's certainly not as poetic as, say, Psalm 104 or Job chapter 38. When you read the Hebrew of Genesis, it reads more like a narrative with these stylistic features in it than it does like Hebrew poetry. Moreover, the fact that there is a topical symmetry between days 1, 2, and 3, and then days 4, 5, and 6 doesn't say anything about whether they're historical or not. I mean, if God is sovereign and can do anything that He wishes, it shouldn't surprise us that He carries out the days of creation in a way that shows that kind of balance and beauty. The symmetry doesn't itself count against the natural reading of the text. There is not a single allusion in Genesis to days being simply a poetical device or a dramatic form. And then finally, we have to come back to this fact that in Exodus 20, the creation week was understood as an actual week of days, 24-hour days, because that is the foundation of the Sabbath commandment. It wouldn't make a whole lot of sense to say, rest on the seventh day because that's what God did, although He didn't really do that. It was just a way of, you know, putting on a play for you, and these are the different scenes. So you can't read Exodus 20 in that fashion because it wouldn't then ground our obligation to obey the Sabbath commandment. So, in terms of creation accounts, that's what I want to tell you about the days of Genesis. I would come back to biting the bullet and saying the natural reading is the one you should follow, and I think naturally it's roughly 24-hour days. What's the relationship? Second question. What's the relationship between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2? These two different accounts. There have been biblical critics who have said, if you're going to be honest, you've got to see there's a contradiction between these two accounts. Is that true? If you read Genesis, the second chapter, in its account of man, you will notice that it's not intended to be chronological. If it were intended to be strictly chronological, you'd have man created and no place to put him in Genesis 2. That's on the theory that Genesis 2 stands alone as its own separate account of creation. I mean, it would make nonsense out of it. Genesis 2 presupposes Genesis 1. You already know about the creation of the earth. What we have in Genesis 2 is now not so much an account of God's creating the heavens and the earth, but a history of what took place in the heavens and the earth, which God created. What we have here specifically is the history of the descendants of the creation week, that is the history of Adam and, of course, his wife Eve. Genesis 1, then, stresses the beginning, the personal beginning, of the entire universe, and that everything depends upon God, who made the world out of nothing by His own proclamation, what's called a fiat. That is, God declares it, and it's done. God said, let there be, and there was. Genesis 1 establishes that. That's where the world came from. You want to know about the universe? God spoke and it came into being. But in chapter 2, the scope gets narrowed. And now the emphasis and the detail is given to man. And that's not uncommon for journalists to do. First, if you read a newspaper account, you will see that in the first two paragraphs of any newspaper account, the whole story is told. Not a whole lot of detail, but you see they'll lay it all out. And then about the third paragraph, usually, you'll start getting the story told again now with detail. And so God is an expert journalist, too. And so God tells the whole story. He says, you want to know where it all came from? Here it is. Now, you want some detail about you yourself, man? Here it is. So that's Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, I think. And in fact, Genesis chapter 1 may not be an account in terms of literary intention. I don't want to be misunderstood. Genesis 1 may not be a specific account of the man, the individual we call Adam, when God created man, the focus there may have been very broadly when God created mankind. That isn't to say mankind was all created on the same day, but there are different ways of looking at a person like Adam. Adam is not only a person in his own right, an individual, you know, a guy who could be your next door neighbor, but Adam is also the first human being. Okay? What I'm saying is, I could write a story about George Bush, and the focus of my story may be on George Bush as an individual who doesn't like broccoli, as individuals go. Or it may be a story about the presidency, even though I'm talking about George Bush. You understand that? And in Genesis 1, it seems to me, you might have the presentation of mankind's creation, Adam representing mankind. But now, in Genesis 2, God says, let's talk about this guy who doesn't like broccoli. Let's talk about the details of the first man. So that may be another way in which the two are distinguished. But the fact of the matter is that Genesis 2 takes as its background Genesis 1, and Genesis 2 is the necessary background for Genesis 3. Try this as an experiment in literary analysis. Read Genesis 1, then jump to chapter 3. See if you can make sense of the Bible. Can't do it. Genesis 2 is the bridge. Gives us the background that's necessary to understand the temptation and the fall of man. So, having said this, I don't think this group needs to have it belabored. I don't buy the critical approach that says you really have two creation stories here and they stand in tension with each other and the Hebrews didn't know what to do with it, so they threw both of them in their Bible. Give me a break. All right, now let's talk about the evolutionary challenge to the biblical account of man's origin. The time came, obviously, where those who were not informed by God's Word and not interested in making it the foundation of all their reflection had to ask in their own way that question that any scientist is going to ask, where did all the diversity come from we see around us? So many different kinds of animals and so much vegetation, all these different species. How did that happen? You don't believe in creation, because if you do believe in creation, that's just one more way to glorify God. You mind if I take a moment and just encourage you to do that? Go to the zoo sometime. Really? Not just because you want to show your kids the monkeys, but go to the zoo and think about the fact there are all these different wondrous creatures. Some are kind of scary, you know. Others are beautiful. You know, there's this interesting diversity. And just think, God wasn't showing everything he can do when he did that. And this is the one we're going to dwell with for all eternity. I mean, go to the zoo. You learn how to praise God. Okay, so when people ask, well, you know, where did giraffes and bears and whales and all that come from? I say, you don't know how good God is. God made all that. Isn't he beautiful? Isn't he wonderful? I don't mean to bring God down. Clever. I mean, could you have done that? No way. Look what God did. But if you don't believe in creation, if you don't have a supernatural view of the universe, then you have to look at all that and go, man, what a mess. Where'd all this come from? How'd that happen? Natural. And the naturalist eventually is going to have to devise a view of gradual transformation. Now, it doesn't have to be the specific theory of evolution that you're familiar with. And you should know, I won't dwell on it because my time is short, somebody who studied the history of philosophy gets a lot of kind of maybe cynical humor and pleasure out of reading about the development of the theory of evolution in the 1800s. Philosophers were talking about evolution all the way back to the pre-Socratic Greeks. Throughout history, there has been the development and the attempt to develop a theory by which you could naturally explain all the diversity in the world. All that the 19th century added to this was the attempt to make it look scientific. Okay, but as a philosophy, as a view of the universe, of man, of reality, it's been with us for a long time. Well, the naturalist is going to eventually come up with some view of gradual transformation from simpler forms to more complex forms. It wasn't until the 19th century that this idea carried some kind of scientific credibility, because it wasn't until the 19th century that someone proposed a natural mechanism for this alleged transformation, or what we will now call evolution, from lower forms to higher forms. How did this change come about? Everybody previously had what seemed like speculative, more or less abstract ideas. But in the 19th century, the scientists seemed to be able to explain. And you know, whenever you can explain how something happens, it gains credibility. And I don't think they actually explained how things happened, but that was the perception. Now we're explaining how it happens. This must be the truth. Charles Darwin's fame came from proposing an answer to the question, how do we get this diversity of animals and vegetation in the world? What he did is gave evolutionary philosophy, and it has always been a philosophy. He gave a philosophical outlook, the veneer of scientific respectability. The title of Darwin's book, 1859, captures it pretty well. It's a long title. On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. That was the title. They didn't put all that on the spine of the book. Be sure of that. So what we get is Origin of Species. But it's the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection that's important. According to Darwin, given the competition for preservation, those types of organisms which are most fit, those which are most adapted to the environment, will be the ones that survive to propagate their kind. The less fit will over time be replaced by the more fit through natural selection. This theory has become something of a reigning dogma in the scientific guild. In 1959, Sir Julian Huxley declared, and I quote, "The evolution of life is no longer a theory, it is a fact." Again, give me a break. If you think scientists always control their conclusions and temper their words according to what they can strictly demonstrate, then you really, I'm going to tell you about this guy called Santa Claus. You don't understand human nature. That is not true. So when he says it's no longer a theory, it is a fact, that is not scholarship, that is propaganda. Give you a little story here. In 1981, the British Natural History Museum, one of the greatest museums in the world, presented an exhibit on Darwin's theory. It called Darwin's theory, and I quote, "one possible explanation," end of quote, "one possible explanation," and admitted that the concept of natural selection, now I quote, "is not strictly scientific." That is, it's not the sort of thing that's empirically demonstrated from our experience and observation of the world. Those few words, let me repeat them, "one possible explanation" and "is not strictly scientific," those few words caused such sufficient anger and political pressure that the museum removed any acknowledgement in problems with the Darwinian theory. It's not as though someone stepped up and said, "Hey, you ninnies, don't you know better? Let me prove this to you." It was political pressure. There was such outrage that they would suggest that this precious darling of Darwin's theory could maybe be not accepted as an article of the highest proof, that people brought pressure on them. And the museum buckled to it. This is what we call the sociology of science. Scientific views being promulgated, defended, explained for social reasons, not for strictly scientific reasons. Now, what's the problem with the theory of natural selection or survival of the fittest? Yeah, I'm going to try to put this real simply. If I were giving a lecture in a hall that I was going to be attacked by the unbelieving scientist, I would go into a lot of detail and try to set this up. But I'm going to try to be very general about this. I don't expect you to become philosophers, logicians, or scientists to follow this, but it is important that you get it. I wouldn't be going through it. When a theory tells you that a certain class of things has a relationship to another class of things, okay? Let's say we want to talk about, I have to make this up. We want to talk about mosquitoes causing malaria. Then obviously we have to know the difference between a mosquito and malaria. Yeah? You're going to relate Class A to Class B, then you got to be able to distinguish Class A from Class B. Okay. Nothing complicated about that? So, what if my theory now is not mosquitoes and malaria, but rather that the fittest creatures or organisms are the ones that survive? So now we've got two classes that I'm proposing a relationship between. The one class are the fittest organisms, the other class are the survivors. On this theory, those creatures that are not in the fittest category will die out. So they don't make it into the class of survivors. Survival of the fittest means we're relating two different classes, A and B, mosquitoes, malaria, the fit and the survivors. Okay? So now, as a philosopher, I have to ask, how do you distinguish the fittest from the survivors? Because if you don't have independent criteria for doing that, you haven't got a scientific theory. You haven't got something that can be tested. And now maybe the coin will drop. There is no way for the evolutionists to distinguish the fittest organisms from those organisms that survive. You know how they decide which are the fittest? They look to see which one survived. Exactly right. Now, you might have thought, in fact, maybe you had a teacher in high school or college who even suggested this to you, which is makes me angry, because those of us who have studied this and are into the technical details, it makes me really angry when people lie and they try to put people on. And they'll say, well, no, we do have independent criteria for what makes an organism fit. And what they mean by that is we have initial standards by which we guess at which ones are fit. But we don't know for sure until we check the history and see which ones survived. I'll give you an example. Somebody might propose that, okay, you got a wolf pack. Different kinds of wolves maybe in this pack running around. One of these wolves is a genetic mutation that has powerful hindquarters. Okay, stronger back legs. So you would say that will make this wolf more fit to survive. All things being equal, this is the wolf that gets to a kill first. He always gets his dinner. It's the others which statistically and over time are going to have difficulty, surviving. So you have the most fit, the wolf with the strong hindquarters. Well, that looks like a good initial hypothesis. But what if this happens? What if it turns out that because of this genetic mutation, the back legs of the wolf are so strong that when it runs fast, it puts an overbearing strain on the heart, which did not adjust to the back quarters developing. And so this wolf dies of a heart attack. Now, is that the most fit? No, it might have been thought to, but you can never evaluate an organism in light of one characteristic. It's always a multitude of characteristics. And because of that multitude of characteristics, you have not only back legs and a wolf, you've got a heart and lungs that have to be taken account of. You don't know which is the most fit until you actually look to see which survives. So back to the question philosophically, can you distinguish Class A from Class B so that you can now scientifically find out if their relationship is what has been asserted? No. When you say the survival of the fittest, all you're talking about is the fittest are those that survive. It's circular. It's not scientific. Now, that shouldn't surprise you, because I told you from the outset that this was not a scientific view that anyone came up with. It was a philosophy. See, this is a perspective. It's an outlook. It's what we call a presupposition. The scientist begins with his naturalistic assumption. He begins with evolution as a philosophical theory. Then he goes out there and he tries to make it look good. T.H. Morgan, the Nobel Prize winner for mapping the chromosomes of the fruit fly. Hey, somebody's got to do it. T.H. Morgan. Let me get this quote out. It may appear a little more than a truism to state that the individuals that are best adapted to survive have a better chance of surviving than those not so well adapted to survive. Amen. That does look like a truism, doesn't it? Okay, now the thing that you have children growing up and ready to go to school, many of their professors will not tell them this, It's the dirty little secret in evolutionary polemics. No one believes in survival of the fittest anymore anyway. Well, they'll say they do, but they don't mean what Darwin meant by natural selection. That's all been abandoned. The most advanced scientists around the world who theorize about these things, you won't hear anything like what Darwin said. They've given that up. They still speak of natural selection, but they've changed it. What they really mean is what's called differential reproduction. The fancy way of saying some species have more babies than others. Differential reproduction. So the whole guts of evolution, how did we get the differences between tigers and giraffes and bears and whales and so forth, that's all been given up. Now we no longer have an account of how we get the variety. All we have is an account of how we get more of one thing than another. Moreover, when Darwin spoke of natural selection, the origin of species by means of natural selection, it's important for people to know that he was using an analogy when he spoke of natural selection. The analogy was to animal breeders. There is something known as selection in the development of animals and roses and other things as well, when breeders come in and they breed for favored characteristics. I don't know, you're out here in Chatsworth, you guys probably know more about this than us city slickers from Irvine, but when people breed sheep and horses and when they, you know, develop their rose bushes and so forth, they develop for specific characteristics. Okay? If you were a person who sold eggs, you'd like chickens that bear a lot of eggs, right? So you breed for that sort of thing. Darwin knew that, but you see, that's artificial selection. Artificial. Man intrudes himself into what's going on to make sure the right animals breed with each other to get the characteristics he wants. Artificial. But you see, if you're not a Christian, you haven't got anything like that to account for natural selection, do you? Well, then what is doing the selecting in natural selection? Oh, I know, you're going to say Mother Nature, right? It's natural selection. Well, hey, we can, you know, be humorous about that, but from a philosophical and scientific standpoint, that's a real defect. Darwin just fooled himself by an analogy. There's no selection going on here. It's a chance universe. Nature is not a person, not like an orchestra conductor, you know, who is bringing all the stuff about and making things harmonious. There's nothing like that in nature. So when Darwin spoke of natural selection, not only was he not speaking scientifically, he wasn't even being true to his own theory. You cannot reconcile the notion of selection to naturalism. Thirdly, you need to be aware that naturalistic evolution requires incredible faith. That's why I love going to the university campus and talking to these people who are so smart about evolution. And here I am, this ignorant Sunday school Christian who has faith that God made it all. Well, to be honest with you, I want to commend the religious faith of the evolutionist. He's got a whole lot more than I do. I'm just, you know, I can only go so far in what I'm able to believe. So I've got to finally have this cop-out that I believe in a sovereign God who is so smart and wondrous and he makes all these things. But here's what the evolutionist believes. He thinks, first of all, something came from nothing. Not with a creator there to speak it into being, but there was nothing, then there was something. I mean, that's not the sort of thing a philosopher goes, oh, okay, next step, now what do you want? Something came from nothing. What? Well, let's give them that, okay? We don't want to be real. We want to be real mean in this argument. So, okay, now there was something. The next step is order came from disorder. There was randomness. It was chaos, but then it became ordered and very structured. How? Why? What are you talking about? Oh, stop being so mean. Give them a second one. So we'll give them something from nothing. We'll give them order from chaos. And then life comes from inorganic matter. That's contrary to everything we know about the natural world. If you know anything about science and biology, life doesn't come from non-life. But we're supposed to believe that by chance, randomly, it happened once. And once you got that, then you can start this evolutionary soup going. Well, actually, it's not that easy because according to the evolutionist, there's a whole lot of trial and error here. And if you read the literature, you'll find that they believe that far more things died out than survived. And so once you get life from non-life once, for all we know, it died out. It didn't survive. I mean, their own material says this. Statistically, the odds are against it, and yet they still believe this. Life sprang from non-life, and then variation arose from everything being the same. And then intelligence came from non-intelligence. And then self-consciousness came from non-consciousness. And then language developed from what was inarticulate, and morality arose from what was not moral in the first place. And I have faith? Let me tell you, I don't hesitate to debate the evolutionist. This is a joke. The only way they get away with anything is by not telling people all these philosophical things that they're taking for granted and are preposterous. Well, I'd like to go on and on and on and do the apologetical side of things, but that's not the specific reason why we're here this morning. Evolution is not a credible theory, philosophically or scientifically. And so what has happened is that Christians have sometimes come along and thought they could help out by merging the biblical view, known as creation, with the scientific view, known as evolution. And so what do they come up with? Theistic evolution. Now we've got a breeder, if you will, an orchestra conductor. It's God. And He's orchestrating all of this so that the natural world develops in an evolutionary way, and yet God's the one who's behind it all. So we have the best of both worlds, supposedly. I love the remark of Robert Dabney, Southern Presbyterian theologian of last century, who wrote, "Other pretended theologians have been seen advancing and then as easily retracting, novel schemes of exegesis to suit new geologic hypotheses. The Bible has often had cause here to cry, 'Save me from my friends.'" That's true. When somebody comes along and says, "Hey, I'm going to save the day here. I'm going to let the Bible be consistent with science," and the Bible ought to cry out, "Oh, protect me from my friends. You may mean well, but this is not the way to handle the Bible." You know, to kind of jerk it around this way and that to fit into every novel hypothesis that comes down from the scientist. Can theistic evolution save evolution? No, it really cannot. When we turn away from speculation to revelation and look specifically at the teaching of God's Word in the Bible, we find no justification for the theory of theistic evolution. In fact, what we see presented in the Bible conflicts with theistic evolution. And I'm going to give this to you real quickly, then we're going to take a break. First of all, the Bible presents the creation acts of God as acts of mature creation. There's no developmentalism in the Genesis account. God spoke, and then the mature creation appears. Secondly, I've already pointed this out this morning, when God created things, He created them to reproduce after their kind. So there's no, you know, progression or evolution from one kind to another kind of things. Thirdly, you've already seen that the days of creation are, in the most natural reading, 24-hour days, in which case you don't have enough time for the evolutionary hypothesis. And then fourthly, the presentation in the Bible of man's origin specifically shows that he is distinct from the animals. Notice the special engagement of the triune council. "Let us make man in our own image." That is not said of any other animal in the creation account, any other creature in the creation account. "All others were created according to their own pattern, after their kind. Man was created as the image of God." So you see how the Bible sets man apart from the creatures. The unique procedure of God is involved. The poetic picture of God forming man from the dust of the ground, breathing into him the breath of life. Man is distinct from the animals, not only as the image of God, but because man couldn't find in the animal creation anything suitable to him. He stands above the animals. Moreover, there's an enormous chasm because man names the animals and exercises sovereignty over them. So man is unique in terms of the Genesis presentation of his origin. Well, one last fallback for the theistic evolution. He goes, evolutionist says, "Well, what about this dust of the ground formation? Man was made from the dust. Maybe that's a way of saying he came up from the lower creation, the dust. God then breathed into him the breath of life, and he became man. Well, you can't really read it that way when you remember that the Bible says that man not only came from dust, but he returns to dust. From dust you came, to dust you shall return. And so on this interpretation of out of the dust man comes, men don't die, they devolve. So toward the end of your life, you start looking more like an ape, you know. And let's take a break.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.